I'm Carlos Morales, and you're listening to 103.3 KWBU FM Waco. Welcome to Behind the Story, a program where we take you straight to the source. Texas State Technical College professor Stephen Moss and documentarian Richard Paul are co-authors of the book We Could Not Fail, the story of the first African Americans in the space program. In this conversation, I talk with the two about the moment in history when the Civil Rights era and the space age crossed. This interview was recorded July 29th, 2015, in the KWBU studio. Richard, Stephen, thanks for talking with KWBU today.
Thanks so much.
First off, what's this time in history like? Can you provide us with some background?
Well, I mean, it actually happens over the course of about 5 weeks in 1961. April 12th, Yuri Gagarin of the Soviet Union becomes the first human being. And so now the Russians have defeated the Americans in the space race and taken this enormous leap ahead. 8 days later, the Bay of Pigs invasion, or the Bay of Pigs failed. Mm-hmm. And American-backed rebels lose at the Bay of Pigs, and now the Soviet Union has an ally 90 miles off the shore. So that's 8 days later. Immediately after that happens, the next day, President Kennedy calls Vice President Johnson, who, among other things, is the head of the Space Commission, and says, come up with something fast in space, because space is going to be the Hail Mary pass that has everybody look in a different direction than looking at Cuba and seeing failure. So May 5th, Alan Shepard becomes the first American in space. And then 9 days later, May 14th, the Freedom Run starts. That's where seven black and six white young people got into a bus in Washington, D.C. and headed down to New Orleans with the whites in the back and the blacks in the front. So that's on the 14th. 10 days later, the bus is firebombed in Anniston, Alabama. The next day, May 25th, President Kennedy commits America to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And a week later, mobs riot around the Freedom Riders bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and the governor of Alabama declares martial law. So now President Kennedy is thrown in with both feet into civil rights and the space program. And Stephen, it should talk a little bit about what happened shortly before that links these two things together really, really firmly. It involves jobs and who hired for federal jobs.
Yeah, with a lot less fanfare, there was Executive Order 10925 in March of 1961. So it was really early in the Kennedy administration, just 2 months into it. And while this wasn't specifically aimed at the space program, certainly NASA benefited and its contractors benefited. And it was to end segregationist practices, racial practices, and racial discrimination in federal hiring and federal contracts. So it created the President's Commission, or Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity. It denied federal agencies the opportunity to hire based on race or not hire based on race, and that federal contractors would be required to become equal opportunity employers if they're going to kit and keep their federal contracts. Well, for obvious reasons, there are thousands of federal contractors and tens of thousands of contract workers, and millions of dollars. And there, with NASA just starting, and with the new dedication of putting a man on the moon 2 months later, 2.5 months later, NASA was going to explode all over the South. And millions of dollars in construction, millions of dollars in engineering contracts, space contracts, and all of these contractors had to be equal opportunity. And NASA itself, as a federal agency, was going to be equal opportunity at communities where equal opportunity just didn't exist.
And you mentioned this, you know, specifically when referring to Executive Order 10925. You mentioned this in the book, and you just mentioned it right now, but why do you think it wasn't received with as much fanfare, as you put it?
I would think it wasn't. I think it had some fanfare as an early executive order, and it was a continuation of other Federal policies going back as far as Franklin Roosevelt's administration and somewhat a little earlier. So it was a continuation of things the federal government had did. So it wasn't in itself anything really new. Mm-hmm. But with events happening as they did in the early 1960s regarding civil rights, and then in this case with NASA, it became critically important, particularly with those installations that would be building and operating in the South. And another way that it became really important is that it led to another executive order about association, where federal employees and federal executives could not be associated with segregationist movements or meetings. They couldn't go
facilities,
to segregated hotels,
right.
facilities. And that was going to force a lot of potentially embarrassing things for Southern politicians and even a few for NASA and, scattered through the South.
When we're looking at the recruitment efforts made in part from NASA, you know, how did NASA go about recruiting African Americans? I'd imagine not many people were eager to move to the South to these facilities.
Well, NASA went about recruiting African Americans rather poorly at the start. If you ask people at NASA and read the memos that went back and forth, we can't find anybody. And you know, honestly, the numbers of people that they had to choose from in terms of African Americans who had experience in some of these places was quite small. But the thing is that principally they sent out white recruiters to black colleges. And if you think about a time when, you know, any African American in college knew that he was not going to be able to get housing, he was probably not going to be able to use the same toilet as his coworkers. And a white man coming to a black college and saying, oh, don't worry about it. If you come to Alabama, if you come to Florida and work for the space program, it's going to be fine. And I talked with a number of people for the book who said, I didn't believe a thing those white men said to me. But around 1962, they hired a man, 1963, they hired a man named Charlie Smoot. Charlie Smoot was hired by the personnel department at NASA's facility in Alabama, the Marshall Space Flight Center. And Charlie Smoot was African-American. He had been hired to do something else, but after a period where NASA was getting its arm twisted by Lyndon Johnson, it occurred to somebody, hey, why don't we send this Negro, Charlie Smoot, out to these Negro colleges and have him talk to these potential Negro employees and see how that works out. And again, I talked with people for the book who said, there was one guy, E.C. Smith, who worked at NASA for 30-some years in Alabama, and he said, I remember they came to recruit at my college, and there was two whites and one black, and the black was Charlie Smoot. And because of him, I decided to come to NASA. So they hadn't been doing a good job. They hadn't been doing it. It had not been seen as important, despite the head of NASA saying, do this, do this, do this. They didn't. But once Charlie Smoot came in, it really did make an enormous difference.
And what were these type of jobs that these African-American people were getting when they were, you know, moving down to the South?
Well, at first, they were principally a job that was called computer. Now, this is not computer programmer. We're talking about 1960, 61, some of them going all the way back to the late 50s when NASA first became an agency. A computer did the work that currently goes on inside of the processors in your computer. They did math with pencils and paper and slide rules and adding machines to take the data that came from meters that were placed inside of rocket engines to determine how much thrust, how much heat, how much power does it take to push a rocket up without burning a hole in the side of the rocket. All of these calculations were done by hand, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people who were hired as computers to do this sort of basic math work. And so this was a perfect opportunity to take people with mathematics degrees and basic science degrees and give them jobs at NASA. And many of the people, many of the African Americans who were the first to come to NASA came as computers. There are also a couple of other people in our book. Go ahead, Stephen.
Well, I was going to say, it's also important to remember the people in our book and most of the people who would be hired in these were entry or just above entry level. They weren't going to be, there weren't African-American PhDs in engineering lining up to work at NASA. If they could get jobs other places without having to worry about the South, they could get jobs doing other things as contractors or wherever else. And we do talk about one of those guys in the book. But they were in their 20s, just out of college, college interns. So they were at entry-level positions. We're not, and they were filling a void within these states, because if you look at the census records for 1960, some of these states had zero African-American engineers in any category.
Right.
And by 1970, they have several others. Many of them are going to be federal employees. Now, what that doesn't necessarily mean they were NASA employees, but the difference in those 10 years in those southern states is dramatic. And I always look at it and say, NASA had a part in this, and not just the Civil Rights Movement and Executive Order and Civil Rights Act, but because of NASA's presence in these states, NASA made a difference. It's hard to prove, but I still like to think it.
And for African-American women specifically, what was it like for them? You know, what was integration like for them into these facilities, if
well,
any?
You said for African-American women. You know, one of the reasons why all of the people in the book are men is because for women, the hurdles to get over as an African-American woman, you could get, you know, it was hard enough to get over the hurdles that the men had to get over, but to try and get over those hurdles as a woman was nearly impossible. All of the materials that I read in terms of memos that went back and forth about NASA trying to find African Americans to work in their facilities, whenever they mentioned women, it always would say things like, we brought in 145 women from Prairie View A&M, and we gave them all the civil service typing test, and none of them could pass. Or we brought in, you know, 120 Negro women from Alabama A&M College. We gave them all the typing tests, and none of them could succeed. So NASA wasn't even looking at putting women in any of these other jobs. And they were looking to see, could you be a secretary? So, it was even harder for the women than it would have been.
Yeah, I want to say that for an African-American woman, that's actually a very common question we've gotten on some interviews and at our presentations. I think the term was a double whammy. There was the racial discrimination of an African-American, and then there was the double of the gender-specific role models of women can't be engineers. It doesn't matter what your color is. A woman can't be an engineer. A woman can't do this. A woman can't do that. That's not to say that there weren't women who weren't doing it. Some were. And that some African-American women may have worked for NASA and other federal agencies in that capacity. We're focusing on the men that integrated in the Deep South, what we're defining as a Deep South in that period. It wasn't until the later 1960s and 70s, where you start to see a greater role for women in NASA, but still in the sciences, they tended to be in the softer sciences, life sciences, biology. They weren't in large numbers coming in as astrophysicists or engineers or metallurgists, welders even. They were coming in as social science, nutritional experts. And that has to do with the greater view of American society towards the role of women in the workplace, as well as what we look at, and that becomes the role of African Americans in an integrated workplace.
Now, in the book, I got this sense that there's this juxtaposition between an often heard civil rights movement and a more quiet battle for civil rights. You know, that is sit-ins, marches, and lawsuits vis-a-vis to the things that someone like Julius Montgomery did.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very true. So Julius Montgomery, I'll just very briefly tell his story, came to work at Cape Canaveral. He was the first African-American ever hired as anything other than a janitor at Cape Canaveral. And he came in at a time that the Ku Klux Klan controlled that part of Florida, and most of the men in his work group were Klansmen. And, you know, every day he had to come in and deal with people who didn't think he was, literally didn't think he was a human being. And the burden that he had and the victory, the civil rights victory that he demonstrates and that others in the book demonstrate, is that by coming to work every day, doing the best job he possibly could at what was then seen as the pinnacle of American science and technology, demonstrated that African Americans were able to do jobs like this. The reason that they felt that they could not stay out of the title of the book comes from something that Morgan Watson, who was the first African American engineer at NASA, said to us, which was that we felt that the whole image of black people was riding on us as professionals, and we could not fail. And it's absolutely true, because if Julius Montgomery had messed up, or if Morgan Watson had messed up, it wouldn't have been, oh, that guy doesn't know what he's doing. It would have been, these people can't handle this kind of work. And so for these African Americans who were the first through the door at NASA, just coming to work and doing the best job that they could proved to their coworkers that African Americans had a role in this important endeavor just as much as white people did.
And I would add to that, there's the view of history itself, because a lot of the events in the early 1960s, mid-1960s, are fading from living memory. The men we write about are in their 70s and 80s, or would be in their 70s and 80s if they were still around. And so the idea of the quiet revolutionary, the quiet rebel of going to work because you're the African-American in the office, you've integrated a federal agency just by being there, that gets lost because in all the retrospectives of the civil rights movement and classrooms, we're teaching iconography. We see the films of the marches, of the great speeches, of the great leaders, but we don't see the everyday, mundane integration of a workplace. There's an engineer. He just integrated a workplace. He just had a civil rights victory that can't be taken away or reversed. It's not exciting and it's not sexy. And 50 years after the fact, until this book, it wasn't even remembered. And so I'm kind of proud of that.
And, you know, when we talk about, like, smaller battles and victories like this, like integrating into this federal agency, becoming this engineer, how was that, in your research, received from the African-American community?
Well, it's difficult to say how it was received by the African American community, but we can talk about how it was received in the African American press. Mm-hmm. It was enormous. I mean, the one of the first things we got access to a database of newspapers for this book that are not generally available in the United States. There's only one or two black newspapers that you can find in American databases, but there was an intern at the Air and Space Museum when I first got there who had access to a database that would show you all of the black newspapers. And the first thing, one of the very first things I researched was, did they write about the space program in black newspapers, or were they so taken up with other things that it didn't register? And what I found was the space program was just as big a deal in the black community, or at least in the black newspapers, as it was in the mainstream media. And so another thing that we forget 50 years out is what a monumental big deal the space program was in its time. And so everybody is talking about the space program. And then one by one, as these people, these men start to get jobs at NASA, it is huge. Front page stories. And not just, for instance, when Ed Dwight, it looks like he might become the first black astronaut. It's not just that. I mean, there are multi-page spreads in Ebony magazine for people who we profiled in the book. Frank Crosley, you know, metallurgical engineer. Clive Foster, who was started out as a computer. You know, and they have these pictures of them working in NASA and headlines about how they're going to help America get to the moon. It was huge. And for the black press, it was so important to show that African Americans could be a part of this important scientific and technological achievement, because it showed that they were as much a part of American society as those who had controlled up till then.
And, you know, continuing that thread of, you know, things that you found in the black press, going through the book, there's this really interesting part, I think, where you're talking about Ed Dwight, and there's a couple political cartoons or editorial cartoons that are in there, and there's this interesting one of an astronaut riding like a shuttle of sorts or something, and it says U.S. Space Progress on it. And underneath them on the ground is a fatigued horse carrying a cart, and it says U.S. Race Progress on it.
Yeah, that was probably 1961. It was very early on, and that probably would have been from Baltimore Afro-American. And the black press was keenly aware of the difference and would be throughout the decade, because that cartoon, the theme of that cartoon shows up in the Baltimore Afro-American later on. And it also shows up in the Houston Informer in the later 1960s. But the African-American press was keenly aware that there were millions and millions and millions of dollars and all of this space-age technology and all of these advances, and we're going to explore the stars, and we still don't have equal employment, and we still don't have equal wages, and we still have segregated restrooms, and we still have segregated theaters and hotels and buses and everything else. So here we are, the great technologically advanced superpower of the world, going to the moon, and we can't even treat ourselves, our own citizens, as equals. So the black press was very keen on making sure that was not forgotten. But you won't see that type of cartoon in the white press. Not that I've ever found it.
No, not at all. Not at all. And not only cartoons, but editorials and columns. You know, they seemed to take every opportunity to any time there was a significant achievement in the space program, you would find a commensurate editorial or column saying, "Well, we did this. What about all of it?" The black press was all over this idea of America is moving into the future, and love to hold up next to that image of the future the revanchist, you know, horrors of Jim Crow in the South, and saying, well, we can't escape our past. If we're going to head into the future, let's do something about this past, clean this up, change this, and make America worthy of this future that the space program says it is walking in.
And there were politicians. I mean, space age was a wonderful buzzword in the 1960s for politicians, especially politicians with national ambitions. Lyndon Johnson would say, because the space age is here, we can't afford to lose any of our people. We have to use everyone's talents and all of that. We need to get rid of these segregated policies. And even Wernher von Braun would become the point man in Alabama for civil rights, which is something of a shock for a lot of people to hear that an ex-Nazi, Hitler's rocketeer, would become a civil rights champion, much to the chagrin of many civil rights detractors in Alabama who would have seen him as a natural champion for their own cause. But it's a strange thing in how you see these things work together, whether it's the politicians, the engineers, the newspapers, the press. You mentioned Ed Dwight, the Montgomery, Alabama Advertiser, which was a fairly, I think most large white papers in the South were fairly conservative, actually congratulated Dwight on his heading towards being a possible astronaut and called him a credit to his race. They also called James Webb a few harsh names a few years later when he threatened to move personnel out of Alabama to Florida or California. But sometimes the white press actually addressed racial issues in the space context.
And, you know, lastly, I'm wondering, and Stephen, this is something you kind of touched upon a little earlier in our conversation, but I'm wondering how the story of African American NASA scientists and engineers, especially during the civil rights era, goes seemingly untold until now, that is, with your book.
I'll give my take, and Richard can give his take, and we might have the same one. My take is what my professors and advisors told me in college. A, if there were anything there, it's already been done. Ergo, there's nothing there to report. And they gave me a semester to prove that there was enough there to carry on. And so I think the reason that nobody ever wrote it before is because nobody wrote it before they did. Nobody saw the connection or the dots or whatever else and said, space, race, and here they are in the very same location. And we got lucky, Richard and I did. I wrote before anybody else had done it. And that was 1995 that I started. Richard picked up with it before anybody else had even paid attention to what I wrote. And now we're finding lots of people interested in it, not just in our book, but in the topic itself. So that, I don't know why no one did it. I just figure it's because nobody thought there was anything there.
I have a couple of ideas about why this history is forgotten. I mean, people talk about the space race in three ways: the Cold War, the Russians, the Americans fighting for dominance; technology, and great men, Neil Armstrong, Wernher von Braun, the engineers who established this incredible feat. And I think that lately, probably in the last 15 years, there is a knowledge among historians that that way of looking at the space program needs to change, and then we need to look at some of these smaller pictures and try and find other ways to look at the space program. The other reason why I think that this has never been told is that it is really embarrassing. It's really hard to talk about American exceptionalism, and, you know, what greater example of American exceptionalism is there than a Saturn V rocket with the words United States of America zooming past a camera? It is really hard to talk about American exceptionalism and include things like Jim Crow. So, you know, how do you talk about America walking into the future and why can't we be more like this? And then also have to talk about what all of what we were like back then. So I think that the other reason why no one hasn't wanted to connect these dots is because it's really, really embarrassing to talk about. So that's my take on it, and I'm really glad that things came together as they have, because, as Stephen said, there is a great deal of interest in the subject, and it's just really, really gratifying after all this time that we're able to bring it out and find that there really is an audience for it.
Richard, Stephen, thank you for talking with us today.
Thanks so much.
Stephen Moss and Richard Paul are co-authors of We Could Not Fail. This interview was recorded July 29th, 2015, in the KWBU studio.